Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 23. What if your stepchild was kidnapped?
Got involved rather quickly. It was kind of like a sweep you off your feet romance. It was very unlike myself. I'm a person that kind of plans things out. So it was fun, it was interesting, it was new. I was a stripper for about 3 years, just through college. It really helped with the bills and allowed me to focus on school. You meet interesting, different people when you're a stripper. You meet normal people in every walk of life imaginable. And people think, oh, it just takes a certain person to go, but it's everybody from every walk of life. He was a patron there and I was a dancer. It took about 8 months to get me to agree to lunch. And finally we did lunch. He was in the process of divorce. I think he was kind of lonely. It was about our third time seeing each other. I was like, okay, I'm not gonna dance for you, but you can come in and share drinks and we can hang out. And that's what he would do. I was 23 years old and he was 33 years old when we met. I didn't know that he had children at first. When I found out, we did stop seeing each other for a period of time, but as one chapter of his life closed, we kind of grew together more. We moved in together probably about a year and a half after meeting. I think it was October of 2002 we moved in together. We settled in Texas. For a long time, me and my husband were very happy. His children ended up moving in with us after a period of time. And we had a nice house, we had two cars, he worked a great job, I was a stay-at-home mom. I always encouraged their biological mother to come around, but I think she struggled herself. I think she's a good person, I just think she was lost for a number of years. I was taking care of both of the kids. His son was autistic and had a lot of behavioral issues. I don't think I really understood what I was signing on for when I was doing it. I was 23, what did I know? You know? You don't really know what you're getting into. So as time went on, I was more of a mother and less of a roommate and a college student that saw them sometimes. I did end up quitting school and raising his children. I think it was a slow process then. In 2004, he had a brain tumor. They said it was a glioma, pretty much benign, and it would never come back. We got married in 2005, went about normal life. We didn't really think about it again. 2008, December, he was diagnosed with a glioblastoma. That was the moment that really changed everything. Like, my whole life took a 180 to where I was looking in a different direction. If you can picture like a poison ivy and how it crawls across the forest, that basically is what these little finger-like tumors look like. So it looks like a big blast in the middle with all these little fingers that go out through your brain. He had some warning signs, nausea, headaches, but he thought he just needed to take a break from work or he was overwhelmed, have a vacation. He had a seizure in the middle of the night, and I called EMS, and the firemen were actually the first one to show up. The firemen took him to the hospital, and they diagnosed him about 30 minutes later. They basically said, you have a brain tumor. For us, they were just like, it's bad. I think the doctors were trying to not overwhelm us with everything. They did surgery about 10 days after diagnosis. They put in these gliadin wafers, these little chemotherapy wafers. I remember he had just gotten the staples out of his head, and we were going for his first radiation appointments. I think it was a combination between radiation and steroids that makes your body swell. And that was really the point where he just started to get sick. It was like the cure was what was going to kill him first. Started to be my concern. When you're 36 and you're diagnosed with cancer, all of your organs are fighting to live. But his brain was dying. He was diagnosed in December of 2008. And by April of 2009, he was already in hospice care. When you have a glioblastoma, and basically they look for active areas of the brain and they try not to cut those away, but they cut out as much as humanly possible. He opted to cut out his left frontal lobe, the whole thing. That is your logic and reasoning. It is a lot of what tells you how to act socially. He reverted back to being very childlike. He would argue with our daughter over stuff that was very, very juvenile. But he thought he was making 100% logical sense, and he was just taking a concerned fatherly role. So it was hard to balance everybody's needs in the house. He wasn't able to tell you basic needs and wants fully. It would frustrate him. He thought that there might be some earthquake or flood or some horrible something happened, so he bought huge shelves in the garage and he stacked them full of water and beans and rice and all kinds of canned goods and survival packs and tents. And I thought it was just his hobby. I didn't really care. It wasn't affecting the family budget. So he kind of went hog wild for disaster preparedness. He started buying stuff on Amazon that was a little strange. There was one day that I was sitting there and boxes just kept coming. And eventually I called Amazon and I was like, please don't send any more boxes. And I just started sending them back with the UPS or FedEx guy at the time. Just, it was reciprocal saws. It was all kinds of video game machines and internal computer parts. It was a strange list. In his mind, he was logical, but he wasn't. I think I was in shock, and I think that I was just like putting out one fire to put out another, and I was just going through the motions of every day. I don't think there was time to step back and think about it because it all happened so quick. You don't really have time to think. You're just in the survival mode. So I kind of released control after a while. But I never really thought, do I leave the situation? A lot of people thought that I might be staying around for a life insurance policy. There was no life insurance. None. I was overwhelmed with both kids. At that time, it was decided that his son would live with his biological mother, and I would continue raising his daughter and helping him. He had a really cool nursing home roommate that was a gentleman that I guess is paraplegic. He had a major accident, but he was in his 30s as well. So they would watch Family Guy together and order pizza. One night, I knew that his roommates were really into Hooters girls, so I went over to the Hooters and I told them what was going on, and I talked two of the girls into going over there to the nursing home and bringing them some Hooters wings and giving them a kiss on the cheek, and it really made their whole week. Everybody in the nursing home, even the old men, were pointing and talking about the two guys that got the Hooters girls to come. He enjoyed a lot of things during that time. At the time he was diagnosed, he made great money, and so his favorite restaurant was about $50 a person. I made it a goal to go to his favorite restaurant every Sunday for brunch. And we did that up until about a month and a half before his death. He deteriorated rather quickly. He lost the ability to really have any conversation. That was the first thing to really go. He began to not be able to focus his eyes in one direction or another. The tumor had wrapped around his optical cords to the brain. So at this point, he was unable to speak, unable to hear or see. It was definitely time. I definitely questioned my religion. I was raised Catholic, but it still to this day I question, because what mercy is there in that? 2 weeks before his death, he almost got like a clarity, and he demanded that I follow him, and he just grabbed my wrist and pulled me up out of my chair, and he pulled me into the bathroom of this little hospital room, and he slapped my ass and grabbed it and laughed, and he wasn't able to have sex, but he pushed his body up against mine, and he wrapped his arm around my hip and held me. And I think it was really nice for him, and it was nice to see his playfulness and his like husband qualities, because I hadn't seen those qualities in a very long time. His family really didn't. I think a lot of their anger was directed towards me in a way. They've all now apologized to me in years after his death, but at the time, they didn't want me there. They had their visitation time and I had my visitation time, because we had had so many disagreements about his care and what was going to happen, and I think they really thought there was life insurance. And then in the end, when they saw there was nothing, they were like, oh, she was really doing it because she cared. I had been raising my stepdaughter since she was about 9 months old. At that time, his sister pretty much loved me, and I thought we had a halfway healthy relationship of sister-in-law, and I was wife, and we all decided that his daughter would continue to be raised by me after his death. It was May before his death that his sister changed her mind and decided that she knew best. She kidnapped my child after the biological mother, me, and the father had all agreed I would continue raising her. It was a straight-up kidnapping. I was very, very overwhelmed in May, and I told them that I would be going to California for a couple of weeks just to decompress and unwind and let my little girl play on the beach and relax. My sister-in-law asked me to meet, and we met in a parking lot, and I was physically attacked. And my daughter remembers being pulled on so hard that her arm turned all red. I remember looking at her face and knowing I had to let go. I assumed when I went to the police department, they would say, oh, we're rushing right over there, let's Amber Alert it, you know? But they didn't. They said that it was most likely a civil matter. She came with her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend. Me knowing that I had to let go and I couldn't continue this horrible scene in front of her. And I really honestly thought I would drive down the street to the police station and they would send people out. They didn't, because I was a step-parent and I was in Texas. later when I went to court, I found out it wasn't a civil matter, it was a criminal matter. And during that time, the sister-in-law decided to team up with the biological mother. The biological mother thought that there was money to be had and that the money followed the children, most likely, or she could at least get it to. And so they both sued me for custody on grounds that I was abusing the children and that I had done heinous things, like thrown my daughter out of a car window. My daughter was in gymnastics 4 days a week. We were involved in all the parent groups. There was a whole courtroom full of people that came to my defense. If she had been thrown out of car windows and stuff, somebody would have noticed it. They would go in there and try to get him to sign papers and stuff. He did sign a couple papers. The judge said, though, that he was incompetent at that point in time. Doesn't matter if he is able to pick up a pencil one day and not pick it up the other. Like, he's not thinking logically. He had a fourth of his brain cut out. I don't know what they told him. I know that I didn't really feel it beneficial. In August, my daughter was returned to me, but then they sued me for custody in August. We didn't finish the custody battle until December. I am a non-biological parent, and in Texas, it's considered always the best interest of the child to be with the biological parents. I was up against multi-million dollar lawyers with kind of no hope, and I looked like the worst person ever. I was the pot-smoking stripper, is what they made it out to be. It was a hard case, but I am the second person in Texas history to win custody of a non-biological child when it's contested by a parent. I think my husband, in a way, knew that he had to wait. When I saw him the last time, I looked at him and I said, damn it, not on my birthday and not on hers, because our birthdays are in December. And he waited until just right after both of ours. My custody was over December 5th, and he died the night of the 26th. Shortly after my husband's death, I decided to come to California. I wanted to get out of the heat. I wanted to get away from the family. I just wanted a fresh start. I think the process of learning a loved one has cancer and going through the whole medical world kind of enlightens you to the possibility of prevention instead of treating the sickness and illness. I've gone back to school to become a nutritionist, and I work in a kitchen where we tailor special diets to people with medical needs. Day by day, what you do is who you become. I think that all the anger and the shock that I was in wasn't able to release until I moved, and then I got a tattoo where he had his brain tumor. And it really took me through like a process, because I wasn't able to even cry after his death. Everybody was like, you're so stone cold. I don't know why I was like that. So I came to California, I shaved my hair off, got a tattoo on my head, and here I am.